Okay, thanks, Terry. And I guess we're going to just kind of get on with it. I am Leslie Gray. I'm an alcoholic. So, and hello, everyone. So, therefore, I qualify to be here and to speak at all. And to speak at this meeting, Kevin asked people to have 30 years of continuous sobriety or better. And so, I'm going to qualify in that regard. I had my last drink February 23rd, 1981. So that's more than 30 years, so I make the cut, yay. Got me this, all of this. But tonight we're going to talk about step 11, which is, could you, you know, I usually write it, and the steps, yeah, just the steps. Yeah, we got this going on. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Thank you. So, you know, once again, we're back to God, the dreaded God, the higher power. This is a spiritual program. There is no escape from it that I've been able to determine, although many others have tried, and I don't think anyone else has found something that, I mean, it's all about spirituality. But it's the baseline. That's where we start. That's where we live. That's where we grow. So I want to start from As Bill Sees It. And again, this, I love this book. It's been part of my recoveries from Jump Street. You can see why mine's all beat up and the ones here are nice. But anyway, it talks, this is a Grapevine article from 1961. And it says, many people will have no truck at all with absolute spiritual values. Perfectionists, they say, are either full of conceit because they fancy they have reached some impossible goal, or else they are swamped in self-condemnation because they have not done so. Yet I think that we should not hold this view. It is not the fault of great ideals that they are sometimes misused and so become shallow excuses for guilt, rebellion, or pride. On the contrary, we cannot grow very much unless we constantly try to envision what the eternal spiritual values are. And that is part of practice of step 11, is to grow and determine what is our baseline, where do we come from, what is our contact with the God of our understanding to be, and how are we going to accomplish that. You know, we often resist. A lot of people resist, and we backslide, and we don't want to open ourselves up to a higher power. I mean, I don't sometimes. I've had periods of not wanting to be in touch with God or thinking life was, how did this happen anyway? And, you know, on and on and on. But, you know, the fact is, if I'm really honest, to be open to God is it's certainly better than what I was willing to humiliate and debase myself to do to get a drink. So, you know, there's a choice. I can humble myself before God of my understanding, or I can go the other way, and I know where that goes. And that goes in humiliation and debasement and all of the things that so far I've left behind up to today, thank God. But the 12 and 12 talks about that, and a lot at page 96 and 97, and I don't want to go too much into it, but I want to go a little bit into it, because the 12 and 12 talks about how we kept rebelling against the idea of bowing before any God. Like I said, we would all hug the toilet, though, and we would all do whatever we needed to do to get money for boozing and on. But, you know, that God thing, that's a little bridge too far. It, you know, the 12 and 12 talks about how we liked AA, and we're quick to note that it had done miracles, but I guess we didn't want to do that prayer thing, you know. And it also notes, and this is the quote, almost the only scoffers at prayer are those who have never tried it enough. And that's been my experience, to just, actually, you know, when I was new, no one really cared what I thought about praying, because that was how they did AA at that point. You know, they said, no one, I don't remember asking you what you think. Just do this. It doesn't matter. Just do it. And anyway, and the 12 and 12 talks about how we fail in our purpose by not nourishing our soul. And that's an important thing as well, to nourish our soul. Remember, you know, to have alcoholism, in my mind, it is a soul sickness. We have a soul sickness. There's an emptiness in me. There's a void that I tried to fill with alcohol, and all it brought me was misery and self-loathing. And I either can reach out to my higher power and fill that gap in a more positive, healthy way. But more to the point, you know, with a soul sickness, you know, the flip side of that is part of the solution. The basis of the solution has to be spiritual. You know, if what's wrong with me is spiritual, a gap in my spirit and soul, then there has to be a spiritual healing to that. So full healing necessarily involves accepting some practice of spirituality. Now, the thing about AA is they never tell you what you need to adopt as a higher power, a gaudier understanding. You just need to do something. It can't be you. It can't be me. It has to be something bigger than us. But do the work we must. The 12 and 12 notes that, you know, it is worth the effort, and I want to note that the 12 and 12 describes the object of our program ultimately is the same, to improve our conscious contact with God, with His grace, wisdom, and love. And that this is, in fact, intensely practical, because one of the first results of spiritual connectedness is emotional balance. So my life levels out. If I'm in touch with God, you know, for me, life makes a little more sense than it used to, than if I'm just drifting along without a God to anchor me into some sort of reality, continual reality. So it's very clear about that, the emotional balance. My own experience tells me that's true. I've learned to live better and to take life better as it's presented itself to me, and it's not always nice. I mean, bad things happen because I'm alive. The world did not stop turning because I put down my drink and put the plug in the jug. You know, life goes on, and it's up to me to deal with it. And with a God in my life, I have a 100% ever ready, always available resource to touch into. So the 12 and 12 talks about also, and I want to say this because there's some of this stuff, you know, again, the actual good results of prayer are beyond question. I mean, all of us who are here sober today, and I would be willing to bet that almost all of us got prayed into the rooms one way or another. So I think that's just a fact. It's all of those who have persisted in prayer have found strength not ordinarily their own and have found wisdom beyond their usual capacity. I mean, when the promises talk about what being amazed before we're halfway through and handling situations that used to baffle us intuitively. But we discover we receive guidance for our lives to just about the extent we stop making demands upon God to give it to us on our terms. So this isn't a demand. So this book is very good, and I'm skipping a whole lot about some of the how-tos, but we'll get there. Step 11, it is about personal and spiritual growth. And I want to go back to, as Bill sees it again, because Bill says it so much better than I do. He's such a great jumping off point. But this is about living and going forward, and living and growing. And this is a page from As Bill Sees It. It's called Love Plus Rationality Equals Growth. And it is a letter, a Bill Wilson letter from 1958 about going forward to live. And Bill says, "It seems to me that the primary object of any human being is to grow as God intended, that being the nature of all growing things. Our search must be for what reality we can find, which includes the best definition and feeling of love that we can acquire. If the capability of loving is in the human being, then it must surely be in his Creator. Theology helps me in that many of its concepts cause me to believe that I live in a rational universe under a loving God, and that my own irrationality can be chipped away little by little. This is, I suppose, the process of growth for which we were intended." And that is kind of why we continue to do these things, to live, to grow, to go forward. I've been through a lot of changing and a lot of living, and I still got a lot left to go, so, and I'm not done. So anyway, the steps we took, I want to mention that again, because I've been going back to this, the Joe McHugh book, in case you're not familiar with this one. It kind of, in this case, I do want to say that how he puts it in page 138, he describes orderly living. And orderly living is about knowing where I've been, where I was, where I am, and where I'm going. And Joe McHugh talks about, and this is true for me, there's always a competing interest. There's our will, i.e. by disease, or God's will, i.e. life as a person with some recovery about me. And I was doing this, I'm going to say this, but one of the things that came to my mind was an old George Carlin thing about when he went to Catholic school and how the nuns were always pushing for pain while he was always pulling for pleasure. And anyway, I still think this way, okay? I'm 38 years sober, and there are some things that are just never going to change. So, if nothing else, my brain is clear, and I remember more things, and I've always had a weird mind. What can I say? So anyway, Joe McHugh talks about step 11 is the step where we put step 3 into action. Step 11 is a doing thing. And he's very clear that to do these things, and I believe this because this is how my life has changed. Step 11, to do those things, changes the direction of our lives. We start to live differently. We stop. I had to try to seek out how God would do this and to start to take that information in and base some of my life decisions and actions on that knowledge and information and belief. I know how it turns out when I do it my way. It is not good. When I try to do it God's way, it's better. It may not be perfect, but at least I learned something. And, when I was very new, my first sponsor told me one of the differences between being drunk and being sober. She said, "You're going to make all the mistakes you made before sober." She said, "It sounds depressing. However, if you're sober, you have a prayer of learning something from it instead of as a drunk, we're just doomed. You're doomed," she told me, "you, Leslie, you're just doomed to run on this endless cycle of the same old, again and again, forever and ever, amen." So that's why making a mistake in recovery is not necessarily fatal to our effort or to our life if we don't take a drink over it. If we don't take a drink over it, between God, the program, the people we surround ourselves with, then we have a prayer learning and doing better the next time. So a lot of what Joe McHugh says he almost literally paraphrases a whole lot of this stuff out of the big book. And But he does make this. He talks about the simple practices. He calls it Bill's spiritual kindergarten for the four. There's four tenets of the how-to of step 11. And there is the evening review, which sounds a whole lot like the 10th step, daily inventory. However, it's kind of double-dipped or maybe double-classified as the evening review, part of making conscious contact with God, where we look at our day, what went right, what went wrong, mainly what did I do wrong, where did I stick my foot in my mouth again, because I've always had that. I've had forever, I still do, sometimes, although way less now, I could never resist poking the bear. Anyone else have that kind of defect? Yeah, I could never resist poking the bear. I've done better with it, and to understand I choose my battles and is this the hill I want to die on and all of that good stuff. So I've learned a little. But the evening inventory. Then the on awakening, thinking about the day ahead. And this is on page 86 in the big book. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for God, after all, God gave us brains to use. And that's true. That's true. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So it's more clear, not some of the muck, so we can use our facilities to the best. We ask, so that's the morning direction. And so we ask God for, then we go to the indecision part. We all face periods of indecision, big indecision and little indecision. So before I talk about me, we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers will come after we have tried this for a while. There's a thing I read in a daily book the other day, and it's something like when trying things is unproductive and then gather information, and when gathering information becomes unproductive, then sleep. And just, and I've found to just, when I start spinning my wheels and grind, sometimes I need to step away and let the thought process, things come to us. Someone shows up and tells us, we run into, or we observe something. It's happened a million times to me. It's like that old joke about, God, why didn't you save me? And God says, you moron, I sent you a boat and a helicopter and a life jacket, It's like, what do you want me to do? So I've told that joke very badly, but hopefully you get the point, that it may not be how we want. And then the fourth pillar, the fourth tenet of prayer is agitation. So we ask to be, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. Sometimes it's as simple as taking a deep breath. Breathe in, breathe out. I have this. This is my new retirement tat. The people on disc can't see that, but it's breathe, okay? And sometimes to take a deep breath, that's the moment that God can come in and stop me from doing what idiotic thing or rash thing I'm planning to do or not thinking. But it, in the big book, it talks about this, the results of this. We have, when we do this, when we spend our time and make an effort to make contact with God on a regular basis, we have less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. This is the quote. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple ways that we have outlined. And, you know, so we're given these four simple actions or ways to use the 11th step to tap into a higher power. Now I want to talk a little bit. I think we're to the last. Good. I don't know if I'm going to out-talk the question period this time, although I make it a big effort to out-talk the question period. But for my own practices now, I mean, they've been all over the map, you know, in different books. The As Bill Sees It, for a while, that was my daily book. But overall, since I've gotten sober, my practice has always involved like a wake-up reading, a morning reading, and morning prayer. Currently, in the past recent period, I'm going to guess maybe a year-ish, maybe more, in the morning I read The Language of Letting Go, and I read a book that is called Jesus Calling. It's not AA literature. The one is a codependent literature. I find those two things helpful. I like the Jesus Calling book. It feels very personal to me. And you can, in any of these things, please don't take that as me telling you you should read these particular things. For right now, I'm telling you what I do. And so I use those books. It kind of sets my thoughts. I don't, you know, I drink coffee. There's no sound going on. Although sometimes I have an app that now gives me like Tibetan bells because it's like formless background sound. So that's helpful to me. So during that time, I literally ask God to keep me sober another day, and I ask to be of use. It's as simple as that. I ask to be of use and to stay sober. God can fill in the rest, you know, and just the regular life practices, you know, we all have obligations to meet, and, you know, I'm aware of those things and track that. I do ask God, you know, sometime, you know, I pray for people, I pray for things, but, you know, I was told a long time ago God answers every prayer, but sometimes the answer is wait, and sometimes the answer is no, and I have to accept that as well. You know, I don't always know what's best for me. Sometimes that's a great blessing to not get what I wanted. But I want to talk to, I might make my goal. Part of my spiritual practice of the past several years, and in fact how I know Terry, is Y12SR, and that is the Yoga of 12-Step Recovery. And that is not a program thing, although it's kind of. But I use it, I mention it because it's something I use to help ground me. Also, and I've talked in the past at different meetings, you know, of this series about when something's important to me, I get on my knees and I ask God. And to practice yoga is to assume a posture. And so when I do that, you know, we're told sometimes to open our heart and, you know, raise our face. And to me, that's an opportunity to ask the Spirit to visit me, you know, to just be there. Here I am, you know, wide open and vulnerable. Here I am. And that's something I get from a yoga practice. I know it sounds new agey and kind of weird, but I do it. And so I'm telling you, that's what I do. And not only me. So back to Bill, okay? And I want to share this with you. I shared this with the lady who was my yoga teacher and a sober individual, and she didn't know about this. So I want to share. This is Bill Wilson in a letter, 1960, and he's actually doing a walking meditation. He says, and he's famously a depressive, Bill Wilson. So if you ever dig into that, you know that. It's called Walking Towards Serenity. When I was tired and couldn't concentrate, I used to fall back on an affirmation toward life that took the form of simple walking and deep breathing. I sometimes told myself that I couldn't even do this, that I was too weak. But I learned that this was the point at which I could not give in without becoming still more depressed. So I would set myself a small stint. I would determine to walk a quarter of a mile, and I would concentrate by counting my breathing, say 6 steps to each slow inhalation and 4 to each exhalation. Having done the quarter mile, I found that I could go on, maybe a half a mile more, then another half mile, and maybe another. This was encouraging. The false sense of physical weakness would leave me, this being so characteristic of depressions. The walking, and especially the breathing, were powerful affirmations toward life and living and away from failure and death. The counting represented a minimum discipline in concentration to get some rest from the wear and tear of fear and guilt. So that was Bill Wilson, letter 1960. So walking and breathing. It can be as simple as that, walking and breathing. So, you know, I could tell you repeated evidence of God in my life. It just goes on and on. All those coincidences, you know, that happened. I was taught that coincidence is God's way of keeping his anonymity. I truly believe that. Things show up, people show up, you know, money shows up, jobs show up, or things are taken away, or troubles are removed, or people are removed, troublesome people are removed, you know, all of these things. If I do what I'm supposed to do, if I keep my eyes and ears open, you know, to what's happening around me, and if I trust, then it works out. I got one last thing from the 12 and 12, and the benefit of, I want to say this verbatim because it's really nice. And it says, perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. We know that God lovingly watches over us. We know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And finally, because this is a little different, and I just love this, so I'm going to ask you to bear with me and listen to it. Blame Kevin. Anyway, this is from As Bill Sees It. This is a Grapevine article from June of 1958. And it says, a man who persists in prayer finds himself in possession of great gifts. When he has to deal with hard circumstances, he finds he can face them. He can accept himself and the world around him. He can do this because he now accepts a God who is all and who loves all. When he says, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, he deeply and humbly means it. When in good meditation and thus freed from the clamors of the world, he knows that he is in God's hands and that his ultimate destiny is really secure here and hereafter, come what may. Thank you.
Well, Leslie, I'd like to really thank you for that. That was really nice. You unpacked a whole lot of wisdom there.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Really?
Thank you. So I thank you.
I mean, you really dug into it. I can see, I've seen others in it. But, and I've seen it from behind here. It's like, wow. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I guess we'll find out if people have questions.
Huh? Anybody have any questions for Leslie? Paige?
Thank you, Leslie. That was very interesting. Paige, alcoholic.
Hello, Paige.
Do you believe that an atheist or an agnostic can develop and work a spiritual program in AA?
I think, you know, I think they can. I mean, that's what the information I have seems to indicate in people I've talked to, you know. So, yes. And, you know, AA is really all... encompassing. So I, you know, if you read We Agnostics, it kind of talks about that, and sooner or later you come to believe in something of a higher power, whether it's some personified deity or not, but there's something that keeps us sober. And I'm going to quote my friend Ken, because what Ken says, and he's a very smart man, and he says, I can't keep me sober, I can't keep you sober. You can't keep you sober, you can't keep me sober, but there's something between us, among us, when we're together, we can stay sober together, and that's enough. I hope that's helpful, because that's all I got.
Another question. Do you find it hard sometimes to differentiate between your will and your higher power's will?
Well, you know, I know what I want. And I know, you know, what I found out is that if my will isn't like in harmony with God's will, it's always a problem. You know, it doesn't work out easily, or I have to force it or push it or fight it or something. And when it's God's will, I may have to work, but to me, the obstacles start to fall away. You know, the things start falling into place. I can... This is a place to tell my job story, right? I think. Anyway, there was a time I was in my late 50s, and I hated my job. I hated it, and I'm sure Paige remembers those days. I hated it. I hated the guy I worked with. It was awful. I'm in my late 50s, and I'm looking for work, and that's not a real happy time for anybody, stage of life, to be looking for work, you know, and I'm educated and well-credentialed, and it still was terrible, and it wasn't working, and I'd have an interview, and I was so frustrated, and then I just thought, okay, God, I'll just walk off my time here in this job. I have, you know, I'm 59, I've got 6 years till I'm 65, and I was at my desk at this job I hated, and the phone rang, and I said, hello, this is Leslie Gray here, and the person says, this is so-and-so from the governor's office, he says. I said, oh, and he said, well, we have, you know, we're wondering if you would be interested in this other job. He said, it pays X dollars, which was basically twice what I was making. And I said, why, yes, I would. And I said, what would you need me to do? And he said, well, you know, the man who is in charge of that area is going to be in Erie in about 2 weeks from now. Would you be able to meet him for a breakfast at the Sheraton Bayfront? I said, why, yes, I could. And so sometimes it's as simple as that. See, there's a lot of headbanging and frustration, and you know, and I worked that job for 6 years. That particular one, I just retired. It was a challenging, wonderful job. It's now afforded me an opportunity to retire in some better pension than I had before. I can say that because I had some extra earnings. So you just, you know, you never know how things work out. 'Cause I was literally just resigned. So I guess it wasn't God's will to get, you know, I'm telling you, I've never had anything like fall away like that. But I've had other things, you know, I've had a lot of happy results from just trying something. Make the call. Send the email. Reach out. Ask the question. You know? Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no, sometimes it's wait. It's wait. But the only way, you know, I know is only God's will ultimately works out. You know, it's only my will works out when it's coinciding with God, or God's figured out a way to make it better for everybody. So hopefully that's of some help. But
any other questions for Paige? I mean, for Leslie. Talking to you.
Thank you, Leslie. That was wonderful. Nadine, alcoholic.
Hi, Nadine.
your description of your path to your spirituality now is very profound. Somewhere along your journey here to this, you obviously didn't have that. Is there a time or an experience that you can share with us that where you started to notice and having awareness of your higher power working in your life?
Well, you know, I had, it first started pretty early in the first couple months, and that was like a second step feeling, that just like a conviction that it was going to be okay, you know, that relaxation and that feeling. But I still had a lot of ways to go. It seemed to me maybe 15 years-ish, things started to settle into my comfort level with it, where I become more willing to take a thoughtful, calculated chance, not knowing the outcome for sure. And I can think of, when I moved to Erie, that was a leap. All I had here was a job and a child to support, you know. I mean, my child came with me, but, you know, things, I owned a house in Pittsburgh, you know, but I had an opportunity to go forward here, so I took it, and it was scary. I didn't know anybody here. I just came here and, literally stayed in a hotel a couple weeks. It was just kind of a funky time. But that was one thing. And I remember driving up here to take my interview, and someone I loved, my late father-in-law, I loved him to pieces, and he was a hunter, and he loved ducks. And I just remember seeing ducks flying back, you know, and I thought, wow, that has to be, you know, you just start seeing things, that intuitive, this is okay, you know, I'm seeing, you know, people believe in, like, they see cardinals and stuff, and ducks is always my father-in-law. I just loved him, and I still miss him. I was just thinking about him at Christmas. So it took a while to develop that sense and to trust that hunch, but, you know, it's experience and I guess willingness to try something, because I beat my head against the wall enough, you know. It feels so good to stop beating my head against the wall. So, and finally, it took literally, I was about 30 years sober when I decided I'm just done being afraid of acknowledging I'm an alcoholic, who I am, what I am. I was wide open at work at the end, and it just is what it is, you know. That's who I am, and if you don't like it, I'm sorry. But it's really funny, and because of all of this, because of recovery, I've had an opportunity to be friends with people who I've never would have bothered being friends with, not necessarily in the rooms, just like nice, decent people, because I can appreciate them now, you know, and I have something to put back into life. But yeah, it took a while to really get comfortable and be willing to let go, because it's so scary, you know. I was the divorced mother and running everything, and I was responsible for everything, and it's not easy to let go under those circumstances. But sometimes the answer is wait, or the answer is no. So thank you. That's a great question.
Thank you, Leslie.
Did I not talk Kevin's question even?
Talk my question.
All right. Okay.
All right, I guess.
Thank you.